The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Dillis Powell, Dennis Norden, Anne Scott James, and Frank Muir. And we go straight into round one, which tests their respective vocabularies. 2 marks if they get the meaning of these words approximately right. Dillis Powell, what is a junta? J-U-N-T-A, junta.
It's a collection of political animals. It's frequently applied in a rather derogatory tone. That junta, they say.
And what distinguishes them from other forms of government?
Well, there are several of them, and they all are supposed to operate equally.
Yes, I'm going to do. 2 marks. It isn't, in fact, the original meaning of junta, which was in Spain or Italy simply a deliberative or administrative council. And it was another word, junto, with an O at the end instead of A, which was this other thing, a clique or a faction or cabal, a political or other combination of persons. But the two words have got a bit confused together. A military junta has assumed authority. It's the sort of headline you see. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, what is a vina? V-I-N-A. Vina.
I haven't the faintest. These short words, it's very difficult to guess at. It sounds like feminine wine.
It's a musical instrument.
Yes, it's a musical instrument. Your partner is helping you. Yeah.
It's sort of good. Filthy noise my daughter twangs away on.
Yes,
guitar-type, lyre-type instrument.
Yes, it is.
A plucky
jolly
instrument.
Good.
That'll do.
Good.
One and a half. You haven't got it exactly. The veena is an Indian seven-stringed musical instrument which has a fretted fingerboard. I mean, that's very hard to say. And a gourd at each end, which I suppose is for resonance. And it is, in fact, a kind of Indian lyre, L-Y-R-E. Anne Scott James, what is a fingerling? Finger with L-I-N-G on the end.
Well, those sort of things are usually fish. But
yes, have a shot at the kind of fish. You've got, you're right so far.
Well, a little fish.
It gets very much bigger, Anne.
Oh, it's not a big fish.
No. No, Anne, it's a very little fish, but I'm trying to help you. It gets very, very much larger with luck later on.
What's a big fish? Yeah, it could be a little formal.
Yes.
A finger fish. It's a little finger fish.
No, it's something that you like.
It's a fish finger.
One out of two. It is a very small fish, a very young fish. It's a parr or young salmon. And at the stage in which it's that length, the length of a finger, it is called fingerling. It could also be a finger stall, but that's a long time ago, the 16th century. Frank Muir, what is a rubber dub?
It's an onomatopoeic word.
Yes?
Like tarantara.
Yes, they like
Where's to enter ours to do with the military? Rub-a-dub-dub is to do with fairgrounds. Now, how about that for a baffling answer?
It's quite good, but what instrument would it be onomatopoeic about?
It's onomatopoeically representative of the sound of a drum.
Yep.
Where's to enter ours is the drum for by the left quick march. Rub-a-dub is a kind of fairground barker's drum.
Yes,
I'll call the Merry Andrew.
It is, in fact, a noun which imitates the sound, the rolling sound of a drum, rub-a-dub-dub. And the verb is to make a noise like a drum. The French do it differently, as they usually do. They don't call it rub-a-dub-dub, they call it rataplan. And perhaps French drums are quite different. 2 marks. Before we start round two, I give each team a quotation. And Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, your quotation is anyone for tennis. And Anne Scott James and Dennis, yours is here today, gone tomorrow. And at the end of the program, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. Round two is a round of moon questions. 2 marks again. Dennis Powell, what is a moon calf? C-A-L-F, a moon calf.
Well, I thought it was rather a a stupid, youngish character.
Yes, that's the figurative way in which the thing's used. But it did mean something very much more material, in fact, very unpleasantly material before that.
More material.
Was it a kind of horror thing?
Yes.
As a calf born with propensities for evil in some way?
Oh.
Well, he might be born with four heads or something like that.
Oh, in other words, a monster?
Yes.
Ah. I'll settle for that.
Yes, I think between you, you get your two marks. Moon calf originally in the 16th century was an inanimate, shapeless abortion, and it was supposed to have been produced prematurely by a cow because of the evil influence of the moon, which happened to be in the wrong quarter at that time. But then afterwards it became used to indicate somebody who was really a born fool. But if you look at Shakespeare's Tempest, you find after the storm that poor old Trinculo says, "I hid me under the dead moon calf's gabardine for fear of the storm." He'd been lying up alongside Caliban, who was one such monster. Two mark. Hence Norden, what is a moonlight flit?
I think it's best illustrated in the verse of a musical song. It's one of the best written verses ever. "We had to move away, the rent we couldn't pay, the moving van came round just after dark. There was me and my old man packing things inside the van, which we'd often done before, let me remark."
Absolutely right, Dennis, you've got the whole of it in those verses. A moonlight flit is a clandestine removal of yourself and your furniture during the night in order to avoid paying your rent and at the same time getting away with your furniture so that the furniture isn't seized in place of your having paid your rent. That's a moonlight flit or flitting. Two marks. And Scott James, what are or were known as moon's men? Moon's men.
Well, it was sort of early astronauts.
No, chaps who operate in the dark, which makes it easier.
Well, smugglers or...
Yes, they're getting there.
Surgeons in a blackout.
Highwaymen.
Yes. Oh. No, that's what I want. Yes.
Highwaymen.
Two marks it is. Moon's men were thieves and highwaymen who plied their trade by night. It could be, I think, be smugglers as well. Sometimes used as gypsies. And in Henry the Fourth, part one this time, I think, Prince Henry says to Falstaff, "The fortune of us that are the moon's men doth ebb and flow like the sea." It's a dangerous trade. Two marks. Frank Muir, you have found an elephant in the moon.
You are balmy.
Yes, that's just about it. Do you remember its origin at all?
No. I don't remember because I never heard it before. Have you a likely yarn to recount to us, Jack?
One and a half, I think. It means the whole thing is a mare's nest, completely true and unfounded, and it has a rather odd origin. In the 17th century, a chap called Sir Paul Neal, who was a conceited type, gave out that he had discovered an elephant on the moon. And what in fact happened was that a mouse had crept into his telescope while he was observing the moon. He'd mistaken it for an elephant on the moon. And Samuel Butler, number one, whom Frank knows well, wrote a satirical poem about it and him called "The Elephant in the Moon." Well, now a round of who, why, what, and where questions. Two marks again. Lillis Powell, what is the most dangerous variety of snark, and why?
A boojum.
Now, why?
Well, didn't it make it disappear?
Yes.
Made it disappear.
Made you disappear.
Oh, well,
I'll give you two marks.
Somebody disappeared.
That's right. A snark, well, a snark was a chimerical creature of rather ill-defined characteristics and potentialities, which is only to be found in Lewis Carroll's poem, The Hunting of the Snark. But the most dangerous variety of all was the boojum, because anybody who sighted it would softly and silently vanish away. And that's the last line of Fit 8 at the end of the poem, for the snark was a boojum, you see, so the chap disappeared. Two marks. Dennis Norden, very different. What is a Watteau bodice? W-A-T-T-E-A-U, Watteau bodice.
Well, I'm resisting the... of saying, looking down at a bodice and saying, Watteau.
she bumps.
I can only take it that it's some kind of fashion of bodies as painted by the painter Watteau.
Yes.
Or Watteau.
Yes.
As they call him.
It was.
No.
You wouldn't like to sketch it.
You would like me to go into this.
A sort of lace up job, I should think.
No, I can't sketch it because my hands start to tremble.
You think very low with lace up like that.
What shape was the neck opening?
I didn't look at the neck.
Well, the necks and the ladies and the paintings were always lying around at very racy picnics, aren't they?
Mm.
And they're cut very, very low, revealing half the breasts. And there's usually a bit of lace around. And they're velvet and they're laced up,
but
or satin.
Round or square, the neck opening. Yes, that's right.
Sort of boat-shaped.
Very poor kind of boat.
A round or a square boat, which is
incredible. I think 1.5.
If it was punch-shaped, they'd be flat-bottomed.
A Watteau bodice is a woman's bodice with a square opening at the neck and short ruffled sleeves, so you've got bits of it. And it was named after Antoine Watteau, the French painter who loved painting ladies in this particular garment. And Scott James, what is the Malagasy Republic better known as?
Malagasy. It must be somewhere in the Pacific.
No. It's an island that changed its name when it...
Madagascar.
That's what I want. That's what I wanted. 1.5. Malagasy Republic is the new official name of the island state of Madagascar, which was formerly a colony and is now completely independent. And it's, though in the native language, it's probably a word of foreign origin. Frank Muir, what part does Eric Blair play in the novel 1984?
Well, he made his entrance and his exit, performed his function, and disappeared from literature.
This is a fairly trick question, Frank, I think.
Very untricky answer, I don't know.
He wasn't in it at all.
He wasn't in it. It was all a rotten trick.
Quite frankly, he wasn't in it.
No,
but he had an awful lot to do with it. That's the bit I'm trying to get out.
Ah.
And you forget about aliases. I don't think I can help much on this. No, I can't give any marks.
No.
He wrote it. George Orwell was the pen name of Eric Blair, who was the actual author of this and of Animal Farm. Well, now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier in the programme. For 2 marks, Dillis Powell, can you give me the origin of your quotation, Anyone for Tennis?
Well, it's always used as a kind of joke against the drawing room play in which somebody rushes in with a racket to a rather well-bred assembly and says, Anyone for tennis?
It usually happened at a particular kind of moment in the play, I think.
Early.
Not quite.
At a crisis.
That's what I wanted. 2 marks. Anne Scott James, I like the origin of your quotation, here today, gone tomorrow.
Something that's always happening to money. But it's an old, 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 old saw or adage.
I think I'm bound to give you 2 marks for that because I can't disprove it. It's a proverb, here today, gone tomorrow. But the first reference, which I think can be found, is in 1616 in a chap called Drax in 1731 in Poor Robin's Almanac. The world is full of vicissitudes. We are here today and gone tomorrow, as the shoemaker said when he was going to run away. This is a joke I doubt if Jimmy Edwards would have used. So you get your 2 marks. And I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being. And for this round, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Frank Muir and his quotation, Anyone for Tennis.
What a strange twist of fate, because I've spent a lifetime researching into the origin of this phrase. Actually, in our village, the Thorpe in Surrey, the first mention is in the Surrey Herald of August the 14th, 1928. And it was the arrival of the first fruit machine to the Red Lion pub. And it seems that it was opened, the inaugural pull on the one-armed bandit's one arm was fell to the lot of one Ernie Capaldi, who was a boy employed at the garage. And apparently he won on his first pull, and the foot lined up, and there was a nice clatter in the little dish at the bottom. And the Surrey Herald headline for that date was, Ernie won four tenners. But I thought it surely must go back further than that, because I remembered when Dennis and I were very young, on Saturday mornings we used to... We were say, sort of 5 and 6 and 7 we were at that age. I was between the ages of 8 because I was a bit more difficult. But we used to play cricket on Wanstead Flats, and we were terribly poor in those days, and really poor. You know, our families couldn't afford overcoats. In October, our fathers used to varnish us for the winter. But we did love our games because it was healthy for us, and I was rather good at cricket, and I always just remember my little apple cheeks flushed with the exercise, leading Dennis, who was always rather way-faced, back to his mummy, and she'd say, how'd you get on? And I'd say, 47 runs me, not out. And I always remember she used to say so wistfully, any run for Dennis? But you know, if you go back into the ancient days of Egypt, there you can find the secret to the first use of this. The first use of that phrase was actually round a small glass phial found in the tomb of an Egyptian queen. She was excavated some years ago, the mummy, and the French archaeologists discovered it and believed that she actually had 9 breasts. Anyway, Queen Nefertiti was buried in her sarcophagus with this sort of tear glass, and in it was a kind of rusty powder, and they wondered what it was. There was a hieroglyphics around the top which were very crude and they couldn't decipher, but only recently they were deciphered, and that is the first ever recorded use of this phrase in the world. And what it was, it just described what was in the vase, which was a sort of hair dye thing which the Queen used when she visited North Africa. And that's where the phrase comes from. The actual phrase is, henna worn for Tunis.
Well, we pass on to Dennis's line, and Dennis Norden has Here Today, Gone Tomorrow.
I've had some very strange encounters in gentlemen's cloakrooms, but I think the most illuminating one was fairly recently in the gentleman's cloakroom of a luxury hotel in the heart of London's West End. The behaviour of the chap at the next basin caught my eye. What he was doing was he was nodding his head up and down and then shaking it from side to side and then nodding his head up and down again and shaking it from side to side again. I watched him do this for about 7 minutes. I couldn't restrain my curiosity any longer. And I said, excuse me, sir, but are you in the middle of some deep internal conflict? And he said, no. He said, look. And turning to me, he made this up and down gesture with his head and side to side gesture with his head again and said, now look, when I did that, did you notice something happening? And I said, yes, I did. He said, what? I said, well, your hair shifted. He said, exactly. He said, you see, it isn't my hair. So I said, well, you mean you're breaking it in for a friend? And he said, No, no. And he became rather choked with emotion. He said, "You see, I have the misfortune to be bald." And I said, "Well, not to worry." I said, "Because they do say that baldness is an indication of virility." He said, "That may be." He said, "But when you've got it, you have very little chance to prove." And then he told me his story. Having been bald from a very early age, he'd become very shy and had little opportunity of mixing with the opposite, and this is his word I used, sex. However, a chance advertisement in the paper had caught his eye about this very latest male fad, which is false hair pieces. So he'd purchased one, joined a tennis club where for the first time he'd found himself among mixed gender, and he had made the acquaintance of a young lady whom he'd got very fond of, and after a whirlwind courtship, he'd brought her to this hotel to dine tonight with the express intention of proposing to her, without telling her that he was actually masquerading under what you might call an assumed mane. He didn't intend to tell her that until after she'd said yes. However, and here he continues the story, he said, horror of horrors, just as the dessert was served, I felt this sudden draft upon my cranium. He said, so I quickly made a trumped-up excuse, made my way hither, and now I've been looking at it, and every movement loosens it more. I said, surely they're not supposed to do that. Of course not, he said. It's my own fault. He said, they're held on by sticking plaster, which you're supposed to renew daily. But in the excitement of looking forward to this evening, I forgot to renew it. He said, if you have any humanity at all, have you anything about your person which is sticky or adhesive? I said, well, there's surely a first aid cabinet in this hotel of this size. That would he said, I've looked. He said, they've got everything but sticking plaster. They've got bandages, lint, iodine, splint. I said, well, that's... I said, what about bandages? Suppose you go bandage your head up and go back with it all bandaged up and say that while you were away, you had an accident. You dropped your cigarette case, and when bending down to pick it up, the seat fell on your head. He said, no, no, he said, I wouldn't feel right proposing in a turban. He said, something sticky. I said, well, suppose I went into the restaurant and I ordered a baked apple. On the top of it, they have those... that sort of toffee bit. No, no, he said, because it might run in the heat of the emotion. He said, surely, sir. He said, you are my last chance for my future happiness. Can you think of anything with which I could hold this down? And at that moment it came to me. I took out my wallet, solved his problems. 15 seconds later he was back in the restaurant and I received a piece of their wedding cake this morning. The lesson I learnt from it, which I would like to pass on to anybody who might be wearing one of these ornamental thatches, is simply a piece of advice for the future. Let your wallet be filled at all times with what mine was. In other words, 2 threepenny stamps and a 5-penny. Otherwise, you can find yourself in the position of the ancient proverb, hair today and gone tomorrow.
Ladies and gentlemen, that harrowing hairpiece story of Dennis Norden's wins the contest of the two stories, but nevertheless, the entire contest is won by the other team, Dennis Powell and Frank Muir, by 1.5 marks, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norton, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.
Been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.